Good afternoon, everyone. The Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on the House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands,
one nation
under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Before we get started, Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang.
Present.
Representative Detmer.
Present.
Representative McDonald.
Present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Edelson. Representative Frederick. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Nelson. Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Sundin.
Present.
Representative Edelson. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Frederick, present. Representative Nelson.
They're joining right now, Grace, so just give them a minute.
Okay. Representative Edelson.
Present.
Edelson, present. Representative Frederick. Representative Frederick.
Present.
And we have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. The quorum is present. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes from the February 24th, 2021 committee hearing. Every member should have received a copy of today's minutes in their inbox. Representative Zhang, do you want to care to move the minutes?
So moved.
Are there any comments? Representative Zhang moves the minutes. Are there any comments or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are adopted. Members, the first bill on the agenda today is House File 1015 from Representative Marquardt. I will move that House File 1015 be referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Finance and Policy Committee. We do have an author's amendment. I will move the adoption of the DE1. Representative Marquardt, unless there is something you want to say about the DE1 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, thanks for moving it. Just puts it in the order in which I would like to speak to it.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Any questions on the DE1 amendment, members? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Say nay. The DE1 is adopted. Representative Marquardt, to your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. So the DE amendment to House File 1015 would create a lot of clarity and peace of mind, I guess, for a lot of these barn venue event centers and other places of accommodation when it comes to the question as to whether or not they have to have a sprinkler system or not. So in the past few years, there's been a number of these historic barns around the state and rural areas that have been rehabilitated, restored to small event venues that have housed like weddings and other type of community events. And most of these barn venues are owned by, you know, small family businesses. And they add to our rural economy. They need to be licensed and inspected by local authorities. So I'm here today because in the last year, there's been a lot of mixed messages out there as to whether or not these type of venues need to have a sprinkler system or not. And this bill really, and by the way, there's been a lot of input from the Department of Labor and Industry on this bill in helping to really clarify the language in this when it comes to building codes and fire requirements and so forth. And so what this bill does is really clarify a lot of that. I also want to say that these barn venues, they are very concerned about safety. They are very concerned about safety. So these are not restaurants. There is no cooking involved. There's no preparation of food on site. There's no open flames allowed in these type of buildings. There's no sleeping quarters. Also, they're open air, so it's easily, you know, you can see things in there. You know, they're all going to have fire alarms in there. And we know that, you know, once a fire alarm goes off, people know what's happening. And my understanding is like a sprinkler isn't triggered until about 160 degrees. So, you know, where, you know, a fire alarm is going to help save people. A lot of times the sprinkler system is just saving buildings. But it's for these barn venues to put a sprinkler system in. Would be about $300,000 to $500,000. And so this bill basically says that if after August 1st of 2008, you haven't made any alterations and your facility that has an occupant load of basically less than 300, you would not have to have a sprinkler system. And like I said, this language was worked on with the Department of Labor and Industry. So with that, members, I do have a few testifiers. I know there's other ones, but the ones I have here are Roy Gilbertson, who's actually a constituent and owns the Romantic Moon Event Center in my district. He will go first. And then Jeff Gasek, from a president of the Minnesota Rural Event Venue Association. So, Mr. Chair, if I could have those testifiers, and I know we have a number of testifiers, so I think you'd like to limit testifiers to 2 minutes, if I'm not mistaken.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt, and I will call the first three off and in order. So Mr. Roy Gilbertson, then Jeff Gracek, and then Chad Iverson. Mr. Gilbertson, from owner of Romantic Moon Event Center, please identify yourself for the record and proceed. Mr. Gilbertson, you're muted.
There we go. Haven't done many of these, so excuse me. Just wanted to introduce myself. My name is Roy Gilbertson. I'm the owner of Romantic Moon Event Center, right outside of Glendon here, right outside of Moorhead, Minnesota. We're just a small little venue that we built up out here. We are all self-owned, self-run, me, my wife, my daughter, and I'm actually training our granddaughter in at 5 years old to take over someday. So we're all family owned and operated and just a small little event center. We are just one of four venues in the area that are outdoor venues that are kind of listed underneath this whole code thing. We host small weddings. We're doing about 45 weddings on a normal year, which this last year and this coming year don't look too normal, but on a normal year, we hold about 45 weddings a year. Some wedding venues like us hold more than that. Some hold less, but we find that about at that 40, 45 is what keeps us sane. So that's kind of where we try to stay at. There's approximately 180 venues like us across the state. So it's quite a few of us, but most of them are all family owned and family run. I just wanted to give a quick overview. I was asked to kind of do an economic impact on our venue in the local area, just to kind of give you an idea of how much impact we do have. We are, like I said, we're a small venue, but when you start adding up the numbers, it was interesting to see just how much of an impact we do have. I took the average, according to Google, what an average wedding in Minnesota costs, and that's about $22,500. Some are more than that, obviously, some are less. But we when you start adding that up, it adds up to about $900,000 just from our venue in this county, in this area. So that's pretty significant from my standpoint, considering that until you start looking at those numbers, you don't even realize how much you do have an impact on the area. We also have impact that comes in as according to travel, according to hotels, all that stuff all adds up in a hurry too. So if you look at the overall, what we do is about $2 million in impact just from our venue alone. If you multiply that by the 180 venues in the state, it comes up to about $360 million just in our industry, just from our little venues. So it's significant. It's quite a bit. The sprinkler system, if we had to put it in, would severely impact that number because a lot of those venues would not be able to exist. They couldn't afford to put them in, so they'd just disappear off this landscape. So we're hoping that you would support us in this bill and move it forward, and I'll answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbertson. We're going to save questions for the end. Next up will be Jeff Gasek, president of MNREVA, owner of Redeem Farms. Mr. Gasek, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Jeffrey Gasek. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. I'm the co-owner with my wife, Julie, of Redeem Farm in Scandia, Minnesota, and I'm also the president of the Minnesota Rural Event Venue Association. My wife and I bought our farm 8 years ago. We spent 3 years restoring and rebuilding our farm before we opened our doors for weddings in 2017. We're now entering our fifth year of safely and legally operating as a rural event venue. Our venue does 45 to 60 events each year at a capacity of 175 people per event. We bring in over 10,000 people each year into rural Scandia. The impact from the corresponding food services, floral, hair, makeup, photographers, restaurants, lodging is even greater as jobs are created around each wedding and event. Rural event venues are the type of business that can help keep rural communities viable. We worked with the local building officials and inspectors from Scandia and Hugo, architects and structural engineers to build safety into our venue and to comply with existing rules and regulations. We have an assembly area less than 3,000 square feet. We have structural steel. We've doubled up all main beams and floor joists with LVL laminated lumber. We have wind shear end walls. We did everything that was asked of us to receive authorization to open and to receive our occupancy permit. We are fully licensed, inspected, and approved to safely operate as an assembly venue without sprinklers. There are over 180 small rural venues in the state of Minnesota. Most are small family-owned businesses that are seasonal and operate May through October. The vast majority have worked with their local or state building officials and have been inspected and received occupancy permits to operate without a sprinkler system. There are four large venues that do weddings all year round that would be testifying against this bill today. One with 13,000 square feet, one with 11,000 square feet with guest occupancy up to 500, one with no sprinkler because they told one of our board members they are historical but want everyone else to have them. Because they were all required to install sprinklers, they're demanding all venues to be sprinkled regardless of size, even open-air pavilions. There will also be a retired building inspector speaking against this bill, but let me call to your attention that while they are not here to testify, 180 independent building inspectors from across the state of Minnesota have already testified by granting occupancy permits to 180 rural venues to open and operate without sprinklers. We're seeking reasonable clarifying legislation that will allow small rural family-owned venues to safely operate and stay in business, not a one-size-fits-all. I'd like to thank Representative Marquardt for authoring this bill, the Fire Marshal for working with us on it, the Department of Labor and Industry for providing the language for the amendment. We're asking for passage of this bill with the language adopted from DALI in support of small rural venues and communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Gasek. Next up is Chad Ierson, from Barn of Chapeau Shores. Mr. Iverson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello? Hello?
We can hear you, Mr. Iverson. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Okay. This morning. Hello, my name is Chad Iverson. I've been a building contractor for over 25 years and with my wife, a venue owner since 2017. I would like to be able to put on a building class for all the senators and representatives to show you what is happening throughout the state with these venues and just how bad it is. But since I only have 2 minutes, and that would take all day, I'll just go over the most important part. The safety of the 40 to 80,000 people per weekend that attend these venues that they think are safe and have been licensed and inspected. With that many people attending these buildings, why would they not have to meet the same requirements as any commercial building? What you have here is a ticking time bomb, and when the catastrophe happens, not if, when, it will put Minnesota on the map. Only you have the ability to stop this from happening. In 2015, there were approximately 15 venues. In 2017, there were 120 venues. Now there's well over 200, and if this legislation passes, you can double that easily. They increase daily, even through the pandemic. Out of the 200-plus venues, I would say 90% of them have not been inspected by a qualified building inspector, and 10% of them have never been inspected. How can I say this? From the pictures that I see on the internet of them online. The fact that, and also that the fact that Dolly randomly inspected 10 venues and not one of them passed. A lot of these buildings are over 100 years old and were built for animals, not people, and have been vacant and deteriorating for years. To build and renovate these buildings properly, it requires an architect, structural and mechanical engineers, and a general contractor. Most venues have been built by their owners or do-it-yourselfers that have no building knowledge, experience, or architect's plan. I've seen pictures of whole foundation walls removed without adequate support, and this is where they put the bar. It's located so everyone can go underneath this floor that could collapse at any time. They remove structural supports and beams because they're in the way of seating or a dance floor. They have no fastening brackets on the structural framing members, and the list goes on and on. I was told by Dolly and State Fire Marshal they do not have the manpower or, in some cases, the jurisdiction to do anything about this. I'm asking you to fix this. You can charge fees to the venues for inspections, just like I have to pay for my contractor's license. I was also told by someone at Dolly, they know how bad these venues are. When they take their family to them to attend one of them, they sit by an outside wall and by an exit. So before you vote to open up the floodgates even more with this new bill that will allow every old falling down barn in the state to become a venue, please inspect the 200 plus existing venues to see just how bad they are. Most of these venues charge $5,000 to $10,000 a day and make $150,000 to $750,000 a year. You just heard one of them say they do about 50 events. You take that times $10,000 or $5,000 and you figure out how much it is. And it appears that the founders of Minerva make some of the most money according to their number of events and their fees. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you, Mr. Iverson. Next three up will be Wayne Butt, Randy Schmitz, and Nick Powers. Mr. Butt from Historic Ferber Farm, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you and good afternoon, everyone. Chair Eklund and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to address the committee on HF 1015. My name is Wayne Butt, and with my wife, Angie, we own the historic Ferber Farm. Just Google Ferber Farm and you can see what a compliant venue looks like. I'm a disabled veteran-owned business here in the city of Cottage Grove, a rural venue in the country on a well and septic, just like the others. We're out in the country and there's no fire hydrant, etc. This is not about shutting down wedding barn venues. It's about enforcing the code without discrimination, prejudice, and preferential treatment. The state of Minnesota has one code book to follow, and hundreds of building officials did get it wrong. according to Senator Housley. She said they didn't get it wrong. Well, I'm here to tell you they did get it wrong. She also said on CARE 11 that a barn has not burned down in Minnesota yet. Well, barns have burned down in Minnesota. They just haven't been caught with people in them, to include a barn that blew down in Northfield the day before a wedding, a barn that burned down in Arthur, North Dakota, the day before an event up there. There's a bill currently in the House right now, HF 109, in reference to former Minnesota governor having to apologize for a Thanksgiving fire in an apartment high-rise in Minneapolis. A great website to go look at, and I threw it in the chat, when it was mnbarnvenues.com. I've got all my documentation, all my history of speaking with the state of Minnesota fire marshal and Dolly. The information is there. They've been pushing it out to all the building officials. It's just that they're refusing to enforce it and calling these barn venues A3 for a church, which is a 20-minute ceremony, versus A2 with food and alcohol being consumed. A three-phase 10-horsepower electric motor here at our farm with 20,000 gallons under the ground is $50,000 for the motor. The system was $150,000. These rural barn venues do not have fire hydrants out there. They have to truck water in. A fire truck holds 2,000 gallons, 10 fire trucks. 5 to 10 minutes out there, that barn will be down to the ground before they even spray water on it. Barns were built for static load, 500 bales of hay sitting on a floor not moving. Now put 100-plus people in that hay mound floor, which is called a live load. It starts to short out the conduit down below in the floor, starting a fire before, during, or after that dance. My website has plenty of fires out there that I've researched. Harmonics. Speaking of harmonics, soldiers in World War II had to stop doing cadence across a bridge for fear that it would collapse due to their cadence. It's harmonics. I was on the I-35W bridge July 31st, 2007, the day before it fell down. I was on my motorcycle. My feet were on the bridge, and I could feel it vibrating underneath my feet. That's harmonics. The bridge collapsed the next day. We can be proactive and enforce the current code as it stands, and I've discovered that building officials throughout the state of Minnesota have not followed the current building codes, and they're failing us. Reactive is change the code back after a catastrophe happens. Just a couple would be the high-rise fire that burned on Thanksgiving, the hotel roof collapse in 2015 up north that caused you folks and senators and representatives to pass a bill July 1, 2017, getting Dolly to go inspect non-code enforced areas. I just determined we can't use the chat window, but ask yourself, have you ever been in a fire? Have you watched a barn burn down? It's on YouTube. How many of you experienced a barn wedding, been to a barn wedding? You think it's safe when you're inside there? I'm afraid it's not. I've talked to my catering companies, and they thought they were inspected like restaurants on an annual basis. They are not inspected. In fact, most are under the radar and have never been inspected. And if they have been, I'll call you out on it. A compliant barn venue is one that follows all the codes set forth by the state of Minnesota building codes. A non-compliant venue are the owners asking you to lower the standards so they do not have to follow all the codes set forth by the state building codes. These folks likely live on the property as a hobby farm enthusiast and sell weddings to pay off their mortgage. Revenue between $250,000 to $750,000 a year. And they can't afford it? I'm afraid not.
Mr. Butt, we're short on time. We've got four bills to hear today, so could you please wrap up?
Sure. I'll send my notes to you. I'm just telling you, if you go measure these barns, their square footage is so large that pasting a number on the wall, 99 guests or 175 guests, is irrelevant. It's not true. They can pack these barns with lots of people, and it makes it dangerous. I urge the committee to not approve this HF 1015 and send it back to the author so that we may come up with a game plan to keep Minnesota barn venue safe. Thank you for your time and giving me the opportunity to speak before this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Butt. Next up is Randy Schmitz, Rolling Ridge Wedding and Event Center, and I remind testifiers to please keep it at 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My apologies. I can't get my screen to turn off here, so you get to look at the barn wall. But prior to historically preserving Rolling Ridge, opening as a wedding and event venue as a landscape contractor and a licensed builder for over 20 years. I had a lot of previous experience in building extensive outdoor living spaces and completing home renovations that were part of the project and constantly needing to get local, state, and environmental authorities to complete these projects. The process we followed to design and engineer and restore our historic property was a lot the same, except this time I was spending my own money. So obviously I was very cautious in how I had to spend that money. But one of the areas we did not give up on was following the safety rules and the building code that was required in the state of Minnesota. Even though I've been in business for several years, I too am a small business owner. I have three small children under the age of 13. We went through several sets of plans over the course of 3 years to follow the A2 occupancy space code, which is the requirement for barn and wedding venues specifically. Many of the historic farm venues that say they're code compliant are indeed, but according to A3 occupancy, which has a lot lighter restrictions on them, and that is equivalent to like a church environment as opposed to a wedding event center with food and beverage. We moved our barn to a new foundation approximately 100 feet away from the original foundation to avoid having to install an additional fire hydrant, but we did install fire suppression. We are within the city limits. Prior to COVID, we were doing financially well. Cash flow covers the necessary safety expenses. I don't enjoy paying $40,000 in taxes, but that was a choice I made before getting into this business. I don't get to pick and choose which rules to follow, and others should not be able to do that either. I believe the Department of Labor and Industry, as well as MnRIVA, is on board with changing these rules because they haven't properly inspected the existing venues, and it's a lot easier to change the rules than it is to try to tame the flame that's quickly getting out of control. There will not be fewer weddings, and the financial impact will not be less. There'll still be the same amount of weddings, except the state of Minnesota will be losing less revenue because they won't be missing out from the construction costs, labor associated with constructing a proper wedding event venue, as well as property taxes. We are not allowed to open in business until we follow all the rules. We sleep at night and knowing that we did the right thing. So I'm just simply asking you to fix this by voting in opposition to this bill until we get a chance to research it further so that it does what it needs to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Next up is Nick Powers from Powers Ventures. Mr. Powers, please identify yourself for the record and proceed. I'm not seeing Mr. Powers on here. We'll try to get circle back to him. We have two more test fires after that. Roger Axels and Douglas K. Whitney. Mr. Axel, certified Minnesota building official, retired. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Axel. I am a retired Minnesota building official with 30 plus years in building code administration. I'm not a venue owner and I have no horse in this race. I am a retired public safety official with concerns about the language in this bill and the inherent conflicts with the provisions of the existing Minnesota building code. I'm here today to speak against HF 1015, urging the committees to not approve this bill and send it back to the author with comments regarding building code requirements that already exist in the Minnesota Building Code. The Minnesota Building Code requires that all buildings shall be classified into one or more occupancy groups based on the nature of the hazards and risks to building occupants. A wedding event center would be classified as an A2 assembly occupancy. An A2 occupancy includes assembly uses intended for food and or drink consumption. Nothing about food preparation. It's consumption. A3 occupancies include assembly uses intended for worship, recreation, or amusement. The principal difference between an A2 and an A3 occupancy is that the A2 serves food and drink as part of the catered wedding reception, whereas the A3 does not serve food and drink as the principal function. Proponents of the HF 1015 want to call an A2 occupancy an A3 occupancy simply for convenience. By serving food and drink, the rural event venue now goes from an A3 to an A2 occupancy by default. An event center is an event center no matter where it is in the state. by defining all rural event venues as A3 occupancies. They are proposing lowering the threshold of public safety by raising the minimum number, the minimum occupant load for the venue to 300 occupants. This means the venue owner would be able to put more people in their building before they have an obligation to protect them from fire. I ask the question, what is the benefit to the public HF 1015 produces? The only people that benefit is the outstate venue owners. In conclusion, I'm trying to keep some venue in the state of Minnesota from becoming another station nightclub disaster, where 100 people died in a building that was not protected with a fire sprinkler system. Minnesota should be known for much better things than a disastrous fire where possibly three or four generations of a family could be killed in an event that was supposed to be a happy gathering. Again, I urge the committee not to approve HF 1015 and send back to the author. I also find it curious that the committee will be hearing a bill, HF 109, dealing with installing a fire sprinkler system in existing high-rise buildings. Curious. Lives in a rural event venue are equally important as those in a high-rise building. Building codes and the fire sprinklers save lives. Thank you for this time. Thank you for the opportunity to speak for this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Axel. Next up is Douglas K. Whitney, P.E., Bloom Lake Barn. Mr. Whitney, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair members, my name is Doug Whitney. I'm currently a licensed building official. I'm a contract building official with the city of Ely and Wabik, Minnesota, and I'm also licensed as an engineer in Minnesota and Wisconsin. I've worked on about 12 of these rural event centers, and there's been much confusion on if they should be an A3 community hall or not, primarily because most of them don't have any sort of kitchen, and they're used for antique shows, swap meets, and other things. Up until about 2015, many of these wedding barns were considered to be A3 community halls, just like a Legion Club, town hall, or church hall, or similar multi-use facilities. In Minnesota, we have adopted the Minnesota Conservation Code, was adopted to encourage the reuse of existing buildings. It regulates the design, alteration, repair, addition, and changes of these buildings. These regulations may often be less restrictive than the IBC, making conservation and reuse of existing buildings more cost-effective while maintaining safety. That's really important. Some now look at these rural event venues as an A2, requiring the fire sprinklers at an occupant load of 100 and not 300 as an A3. And I will say we heard a lot about all these things about structural and all these other things. You know, and I don't believe, you know, we're trying to avoid any of that stuff. And I am speaking in favor of the bill. A group A2 occupancies include uses intended for food and drink, but it talks about restaurants, cafeterias, and similar dining facilities, including an associated commercial kitchen. There really isn't any definition of a banquet hall, but I was able to find a definition of a banquet hall, and it does require provisions for the preparation of food and generally seating over 300. Earlier last year, a complaint was filed against me with the Board of Architects and Engineers, alleging that the Bloom Lake Barn was misclassified as an A3 community hall and an automatic fire sprinkler system requirement in the IBC was ignored. The complaint committee was satisfied that no violation of the alleged violations was found. There's a lot of building officials and designers that are really nervous about getting into these facilities right now because of the inconsistency and confusion over how to classify these buildings. In Wisconsin, this has already been dealt with. Their code states where there is no municipal water, it can be classed an A2. Can have up to 300 people with a floor area of 12,000 square feet and exiting at grade. So Wisconsin's already addressed this conundrum where you have these event facilities when there's no city sewer and water available. I believe that this House File 1015 will clarify the classification of the rural event venues. This bill does not exempt them from fire sprinkling requirements when they exceed, you know, the floor areas or exceed the occupant load of 300, or with the floor would not be at the level of exit at discharge at grade. So, and it doesn't exempt them from structural requirements or flame spread requirements or, you know, fire alarm requirements or any of those kind of things. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask.
Thank you, Mr. Members, before we go to member questions, I want to remind you that this bill, when it leaves this committee, will be going to public safety, where a lot of these issues will be examined there. Any member questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for maybe Mr. Butt. I've been around the industry, wedding industry, for 33 years, photographing in from Legion halls to VFW halls to barns, and you name it, I shot it. Many historic facilities and buildings as well that don't have a sprinkler system. The thing with the barns is, you know, there's many wide open doors, big entrances. Oftentimes they're safer than 100-year-old buildings that I've photographed and that people have receptions in. So just curious as to what your thoughts are on that. Should we be retrofitting all historic structures then? You seem to say that not if, but when there'll be a disaster. What about all the other buildings that don't have the sprinkler systems and aren't as safe as a newly constructed barn and or a completely renovated barn of these venues and the owners?
Mr. Butt.
Yes, sir. So just to be clear, if you go to ferberfarm.com, you'll see our barn and how we had to renovate it and put steel in there to support the floor load, the wind load, and the snow load. And so when you go inspect these barns, and I do it either in person or I do it online, you can see that they've cut corners and that they are not up to code. I can see floor joists that are 2 feet on center, and to have 100 pounds per square foot, they have to be either 12 or 16 inches on center. So looking at pictures and those that spoke today, I can go find things wrong with their venues. Exit signage will be covered up with the plank, drapings, etc. So if you look and have a certified or licensed architect and engineer, they would do a code analysis on said structure, these old structures. And I can show you what mine looks like, and I'll email it to you after this meeting of what that looks like. When I went around asking building officials throughout the county, Goodhue County and Isani County, I couldn't find these. They weren't engineered properly. So these documents are missing in their file, and that's wrong. Bloom Lake Barn, I don't know if he's talking today, Adam up there has a barn larger than the Ferber Farm. It's 9,000 square feet divided by 15 square feet per person sitting at a table is over 600 people in that barn. So even if you pass this law today and say 300 people or less doesn't require a sprinkler, I'm going to prove to you that every barn out there is going to need a sprinkler because they go well over that number pasted on the wall. Putting a number on the wall is arbitrary, but actually taking a tape measure and measuring the square footage, you'll determine that they're all over the square footage for 300.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Butt, I think that viewing a barn or a venue on the website compared to going in person and visiting these structures themselves with the owners, if you had these concerns, probably would be more productive than just looking at them on the internet. And I think everybody appreciates and understands your concern of public safety. But more importantly, those who have businesses in these venues are equally concerned, and probably even more so than the state can mandate, will ensure that its participants, oftentimes their neighbors, families, and friends in their communities, will be perfectly safe. Nothing is going to prevent, every disaster, but the business owners will do everything they can to make sure that their participants, their business, their customers are going to be safe whatsoever at always. Not to mention, you did mention something about this is a opportunity for some of these venues not to be following fire codes or city codes. I seriously doubt that. I don't think that is the case whatsoever. Every township or city has their own fire codes or based on the state codes, and will be making sure that they follow it in, you know, opening up their businesses and their venues. So, and not to mention some of the advantages, some of the cases that you made in your scenario of other structures burning down, none was farms, none were barns. It was all other structures, not barns. So there is no evidence at all or at this point.
Sir,
Representative Detmer.
My Senator Carla
Bailey. Mr. Butt, you run through the chair, and Representative McDonald was done with his questioning. That was a comment. Representative Detmer is up. Representative
Detmer. Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and also Representative Marquardt for bringing this bill forward, and also Dolly for helping putting the language together. And the DE-1 amendment answered a lot of my questions that I had. And I agree with the chair that a lot of these questions will be brought up in the next committee meeting. And I see that in the Senate, they're going to have a hearing tomorrow. And I think those types of questions are going to be answered in the next committee. And I've been to a couple of the venues in my district, in Scandia, and also up in the Schaefer or Franconia area for different events. And I'm really impressed how these small businesses, the families that run these businesses have put their, upgraded their facilities, upgraded their land for outdoor activities. And so I was really impressed the venues that I went to. So thank you, Representative Mark.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question to the author, Chair Marquardt. Has our friends from the United Association of Pipe Trades weighed in on this particular issue? If so, what have they said?
Chair Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, I am not aware if they have or not. I'm not aware of it.
Okay. Thank you,
Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further comments or questions, Chair Marquardt, you have any final comments on your bill?
I do. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, for having this discussion. I'm certainly open to suggestions to make this bill better. We're just looking for clarity. And I do want to say that and emphasize again, these owners are very concerned about safety. It's their reputation on the line. They're liable if something happens. And you know, I think there's a few things thrown out that are unrelated to this bill. You know, the construction building codes, that's not what this bill is about. We're talking about whether or not they need sprinklers or not. This is not a high rise. This is not the Station Night. That Station Night fire that's referred to, there was a fireworks display, pyrotechnics going on with a low ceiling, totally something unrelated. The bottom line is that these barn venues are open. They have all safety requirements as far as fire extinguishers, fire alarms, all those things. They're going to be able to alert people that there is something happening at that time. And I just think we have to, you know, make this balance between, you know, $300,000 to $500,000, and is it this huge safety concern? And so, members, I appreciate your time with this, and would hope for your support.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. I will renew my motion that House File 1015, as amended, be referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Yes.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Aye.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, aye.
McDonald, aye. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Pass.
Nelson, pass. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Pass.
Sundin, pass. We have 11 ayes to abstain.
Chair Marquardt, you're on your way to public safety.
Thanks so much, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate it. Thank you much.
Members, next bill on the agenda is House File 109 from Representative Knorr. I will move that House File 109 be referred to the General Register. Representative Knorr, welcome, and please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to hear this bill. House File 109 is a bill that requires retrofitting high-rise buildings, residential buildings above 75 feet with fire sprinklers. Mr. Chair and members, on the 25th of November, 2019, I saw some lights. I saw many people calling me, and I saw the fire trucks. So many people who were mourning the death of five individuals who were killed in my district in a high-rise building. The fire started on the 14th floor on City Riverside High-Rise building, and five people lost their lives, including a firefighter who was injured as they tried to save lives. This is what we're trying to prevent, Mr. Chair, with this bill. This bill has been before the body in 1994-95. Fortunately, during those days, the bill was vetoed because there was no agreement on this bill. But today, this is a moment that we cannot go back. In fact, those individuals and the governor who was involved said that it was a mistake. This is an opportunity for us to provide support to the firefighters. In any given fire, you need three things. You need firefighters, you need fire alarm, and you need fire sprinklers. In fact, in the lessons learned from the incident that took place on the 25th, from the public safety state fire marshal, who's also with us here to testify on this bill, indicated that if we had sprinklers, we could have saved the lives of those five individuals. We will not be here today speaking about this bill, but tragically, because of that incident, we're here asking for your support. Members, this is an opportunity for us to address public safety and to support our firefighters. We can create this bill that supports public housing, because most of the housing that I'm talking about, they are predominantly owned by the public. And that, we have to make a difference. There are resources from the federal government, there are resources within the state level that we can support our public housing units. I would like to open this to the testifiers who are here today to testify on this bill. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. First testifier is Tom Brace. Mr. Brace, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Brace. I was previously the Washington State Fire Marshal for 10 years and the Minnesota State Fire Marshal for 16 years during that period that Representative Knorr talked about the first attempt. I think this bill offers an unparalleled level of safety, and I wanted to focus on just a couple of items. Number one, that the owners of the building, whether they be public housing or a commercial venture, have 12 years to comply to this, and they would work in concert with the Minnesota State Fire Marshal to perform a schedule and a planned program to bring about compliance. 12 years. Some have argued that's way too long, others not enough. We noticed that noted that the city of St. Paul over a 20-year period was able to sprinkler all of its high-rise buildings, and we salute their efforts. We have with us this afternoon the former fire chief of St. Paul, Mr. Tim Butler, that will talk about the fire department and fire department response to these tragic events. But I wanted to just mention briefly the Public Housing Fire Safety Act, specifically on point to the question about funding. That is a piece of legislation that's currently being sponsored by both of our national senators, Senator Smith and Senator Klobuchar. Senator Smith was just appointed to the Housing and Transportation and Commerce Subcommittee. Their last bill last year was the first time had a $25 million appropriation for 10 years. So I would like to reassure the public housing folks, particularly who have a concern about certainly financial wherewithal to accomplish this, that we are working at the federal level and, as Representative Knorr indicated, at the state level, looking for solutions to help assist in this funding for this vital program. Thank you very much. And as I say, we have former Fire Chief Tim Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Brace. Next up is Tim Butler. Mr. Butler, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Tim Butler. Can you shut off your speaker too, Tom? I'm the North Central Regional Manager for the National Fire Sprinkler Association. And more importantly, I'm a 30-year veteran of public safety, having served in fire, police, emergency communications, and emergency management. Before joining the National Fire Sprinkler Association, I served as a St. Paul fire chief from 2007 to 2017. During my time as fire chief, the St. Paul Public Housing Authority completed a multi-year project to install fire sprinkler systems in all 16 of their existing high-rise buildings. They did that simply by putting the safety of their residents and firefighters ahead of cosmetic and convenience items like new floor coverings and upgraded appliances. John Gutzman, the executive director of the St. Paul Public Housing Authority, put it best: putting fire sprinklers in his high-rise buildings was a choice to build safe and affordable housing. St. Paul retrofitted 2,500 units in 16 buildings at a cost of $2,000 per unit. St. Paul did it with no additional funding allocations. They did it with minimal disruption to the residents in just two short visits to each unit, and no resident was displaced at the end of each business day. If the St. Paul Public Housing Authority can retrofit their high-rise buildings, so can other building owners. While there's clearly an upfront investment to be made by the property owner, there's a 12-year phase-in period. As Tom mentioned, fire sprinkler system is a valuable investment in property. It extends far beyond the cost of materials, labor, and amenities. Fighting a high-rise fire, as Tom mentioned, is extremely dangerous and demanding for firefighters. The fires grow deadly before firefighters even have a chance to arrive. At the Cedar High fire, firefighters arrived from just 1 mile away, arrived in 3 minutes, and yet five people died before they arrived. When they did arrive, they faced a wind-driven inferno, a fire so hot that it warped steel doors and toxic smoke that filled more than 10 floors of the building. Fire sprinklers activate in less than a minute. They control and contain the fire while it's still small, giving occupants time to escape and time for firefighters to arrive. They also keep fire small so they don't reach the stage that they produce toxic clouds of gases, deadly carbon monoxide, and the carcinogens that are causing deadly cancer in our firefighter ranks. So if you care at all about firefighter cancer issues, then you simply have to support the installation of automatic fire sprinkler systems. Uncontrolled high-rise fires also require huge amounts of resources, oftentimes as many as 300 firefighters, to search the building and rescue occupants. The National Fire Sprinkler Association stands fully ready to assist building owners in finding retrofit solutions that work for their specific buildings within the 10-year timeline set forth in House File 109. And I want to thank you for the chance to address the committee today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Next testifier is Trinidad John Uribe III. Mr. Uribe, I hope I got your name right, from the Sprinkler Fitters Local 417. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And yes, you did say it correctly, Mr. Chair. My name is Trinidad Uribe III, business manager of Sprinkler Fitters Local 417, established here in the Twin Cities since 1903. Also, considering the committee that I'm addressing here today, I think it's appropriate to mention that I'm also the commander of AMVETS Post Number 5 here in St. Paul. I want to thank you again for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 109 in buildings without fire protection sprinklers. The occupants and the residents and the first responders are at a complete disadvantage to survive when a fire occurs. It's not just the fire itself, but also the deadly gases that are created by the burning materials inside of these buildings. I'm a Minnesota certified licensed journeyman sprinkler fitter with over 21 years of experience in the trade, including over 10 years as an instructor for our apprenticeship program. Prior to me becoming the business manager, I had had numerous opportunities to retrofit high-rise buildings, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, schools, and commercial buildings. With calculated planning, the retrofitting of these buildings is not an intrusive process. It can be done efficiently and safely for the residents that live in these buildings. This is an opportunity to ensure that we will not have any more lives lost due to the lack of fire protection in any high-rise buildings in the state of Minnesota. These existing high-rise buildings without fire sprinklers lack the new technologies of the fire industry that newly constructed buildings have. This bill will give that opportunity to make sure these buildings are safe for all. Sprinkler Fitters Local 417 represents close to 700 members. They fabricate, install, and maintain life safety fire protection systems within the state of Minnesota. My members not only work in the fire protection industry, but we are all great advocates for fire safety. In some cases, even sprinkler their own homes for the safety of their families. We save lives and protect properties every day. We believe in automatic fire sprinkler systems and strongly support House File 109. Thank you, and I'll be here for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Uribe. Next up is Jim Smith, State Fire Marshal. Mr. Smith, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Smith, and I am the State Fire Marshal for the state of Minnesota. Since 2004 in Minnesota alone, there have been 64 fires that have started on or above the seventh floor in a high-rise building. You'll see the number 75 feet in the bill, and that is NFPA's number for basically the highest point at which an aerial apparatus can reach, even though they may be 100 feet in length. The seventh floor is the industry standard for the definition of a high-rise structure. The greatest majority of these high-rise fires that occurred in multifamily residences. Interestingly enough, there was an automatic fire sprinkler system present in each of those structures, each of those 64 structures. A single sprinkler head extinguished the fire. Let me say that again, just one sprinkler head extinguished the fire in those 64 structure fires. The main difference between those 64 fires and the deadly fire that occurred on November 27th at 630 Cedar is that there was no automatic sprinkler system installed to protect the residents who live there. The fire started quite accidentally. It started as a small fire that grew to a mammoth proportions, consuming a small 400 square foot apartment and creating thick, choking, toxic black smoke that filled the hallways and stairwells of the apartment complex. It created an atmosphere that made it tremendously difficult and in some cases impossible to escape. The tragedy of losing these five innocent people is only magnified by the simple fact that this disastrous fire would have been quickly contained, if not completely extinguished, had there been the presence of an automatic fire sprinkler system in that apartment of origin. Members of the committee, the mission of the State Fire Marshal Division is to protect the lives and property of every single person residing in or even simply passing through the great state of Minnesota. To be clear, the State Fire Marshal has and will always strongly advocate for the installation of automatic fire sprinklers in all multifamily high-rise dwellings. Members of the committee, through this legislation and proposed federal assistance, as Mr. Brace talked about, and along with public-private partnerships, we have now a path leading us forward to retrofit every single multi-story apartment building in the state of Minnesota. I thank you for your time, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Member questions or comments on the bill? Representative McDonald.
Yes. Thank you. Question here in regards to the timetable of 12 years. Now, I see that one of the testifiers said, maybe it was Trini, that it would be $2,000 per unit, but in 12 years, that, of course, will go up. So I'm just curious as to maybe Representative Knorr, is the 12 years, what's the situation with such a long wait period? Isn't it just to get everybody to comply or get the financial means that necessary to implement? I'm just curious with that.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald, that's the exact reason to give the building owner some time to access resources and for us to also ask for federal funding for the public housing and including even the capital investment that we do provide the public housing to structure some resources will take some time. And we want to allow the rotation process, as you've had from Mr. Uribe, that you can move one unit after the other and do the installation. So it gives them more time to install one at a time to complete all the units that require the sprinklers at this point. And I think we're giving people more time so that they know they can access other opportunities down the road.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knorr, then just quickly, as far as federal money available, what any particular amount that you believe that could qualify for?
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald, I believe for the public housing, that opportunity can be immediate because the responsibility for public housing lies with the federal government. In fact, at one point, I was informed about reserve account. If we mandate this bill requiring retrofitting sprinklers, I think the public housing could access some reserve account to get them to comply with this new law.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knorr, just in that last comment about letting them comply for the law, but if this does become law, they'll have to comply whether or not we get any federal funding or not. Is that correct?
Chair Knorr.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, yes. In fact, the public housing in Minneapolis is starting to retrofit some of the buildings with or without this law. It's a common sense process to make sure that we give individuals safety and to be able to assure them what happened on the 27th of November will not happen again.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question for Mr. Trinidad.
Please proceed.
Yeah. So we've actually met a couple times, good friend. And a question for you, once this goes into effect in law, will you have enough personnel in your local 417 to be able to implement and change many of these structures or the apartments to be fitted with sprinklers?
Mr.
Personnel.
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative McDowell, we here, our particular local or the members we represent, we cover the 6-county metro area. Now, I do believe if from last testimony or from the State Fire Marshal's office, there are approximately 23 or 24 high-rises in Minneapolis alone that would require high-rises to be sprinkled. To us, that is not an issue of supplying our members and our contractors to get this work done effectively, efficiently, and as soon as possible. That should not be an issue at all whatsoever.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, then good to hear because our good friend, our shared friend, Mr. Bistadu, Craig Bistadu, wants to know if there's not enough personnel, will you get out and in the field and install these yourself and get out of the office? So he wanted me to ask that.
He should be asking himself that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Trinidad.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, just one quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe for the author, Representative Knorr. How many of the high-rises in Minneapolis are owned by the city of Minneapolis?
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. None of the high-rise buildings are owned by Minneapolis. Those are public housing that are run through the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. There are individuals, Mr. Brace may be able to give us a, or the state fire marshal can give us the number of buildings that require retrofitting just to get the numbers.
Mr. Brace or Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the number that we have been using was a combination of 23 for the city of Minneapolis, approximately 46 throughout the state. The state fire marshal division did a survey, if you will, of trying to answer that specific question. We believe it to be less than 100 total buildings. Now, that's residential and commercial as well, not just residential, residential and commercial that would fit that definition, 75-foot definition of high-rise that is code language.
Representative Detmer.
And quick, thank you, Mr. Chair. And if a person who owns, say, owns a high-rise and decides not to retrofit and changes the purpose of the building, let's say not have anything above 75 feet, how does that fall under the statute?
Chair Knorr or Mr. Brace?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Brace can respond to that question.
Mr. Brace.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if it fits the definition of more than 75 feet and you change the occupancy, in other words, what it was going to be, maybe it was a office space and you change to warehouse, it would still fall under the code provisions adopted by the state of Minnesota that it would be required to be sprinklered. So just changing it would not eliminate the sprinkler requirement.
Okay. Thank you. Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Brace.
I'm not seeing any other member questions. I have one comment. The place that I'm staying had the fire department got called out doing a water line break, and I'm very impressed with what our fire folks did. See all the gear they have to carry. I just want to thank them. Any further final comments, Chair Knorr, on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a great bill, and I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. I will renew my motion that House File 109 be referred to the General Register. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Yes.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Aye.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, aye.
McDonald, aye. Representative Berg.
Yes.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. Representative Nelson.
I think we can move on, Ms. Doyle.
Okay. All right, there are 12 ayes, zero nays.
12 ayes and zero nays. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Chair Knorr. Next bill on the agenda is House File 1442 from Vice Chair Zhang. Vice Chair Zhang, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I would like to move House File 1442.
House File 1442, the motion is to refer to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Please explain your bill, Vice Chair Zhang.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. This proposal is looks to update the Minnesota Code of Military Justice and related statutes to better reflect changes to corresponding federal law and to remediate potential weaknesses in our existing court-martial process. In this bill, there are five main purposes. It modifies Minnesota Statutes 192.67 that authorizes the release of law enforcement information to be used for disciplinary action under the Minnesota Code of Military Justice, and modifies Section 1391 and 1393 to clarify that certain data regarding members of the National Guard is inherently federal data and therefore subject to Freedom of Information Act rather than the Minnesota Data Practices Act. Secondly, it modifies Section 192A.15 and 192A.155 and adds language to the statute 192A that allows, under certain conditions, military attorneys who are not members of the Minnesota Bar to perform limited legal duties under the supervision of the Minnesota National Guard staff judge advocate. And thirdly, it clarifies certain jurisdictional details regarding when service members are subject to discipline under the Minnesota Military Code of Justice, and clarifies that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is the proper investigative authority for military-specific crimes, updates the code to align with recent changes to the federal code, the Federal Uniform Code of Military Justice, and to allow procedural commonality with the federal codes. And fourth, it modifies various clauses in the Minnesota Statute 192A to clarify the process for appeals of court-martial verdicts and to better align verbiage with Section 192A with broader Minnesota law, the statute of limitations and penalties. And lastly, it updates the punitive articles, Minnesota Statute 192A, to mirror recent changes to the federal code, to mirror with the changes to the federal code, including acts by persons in position of special trust and non-consensual distribution of intimate images, among others. And with that, I would like to pass it on to Lieutenant Colonel Blomgren.
Thank you, Vice Chair Zhang. Lieutenant Colonel David Blomgren, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, I am Lieutenant Colonel David Blomgren and serve as the General Counsel for the Minnesota National Guard and Department of Military Affairs, where I serve as a full-time legal advisor to the Adjutant General and other senior leaders in the organization. I assumed this role in 2018 after spending 11 years on active duty in the Air Force. First, let me thank you for inviting me to testify this afternoon in support of this bill. Compared to the active duty force, our military justice structure...
Mr. Blomgren, we've lost your audio. I don't know. Mr. Blomgren, or Lieutenant Colonel?
...will provide that additional... and the commander's toolbox to ensure good order and discipline in the Minnesota National Guard. One of the gaps we've experienced in the National Guard is the inability of out-of-state attorneys to provide military legal advice without having to go through the pro hoc vice process. This bill would allow for out-of-state licensed attorneys to provide military defense services or service military judges, provided that they are otherwise qualified for such duty by the judge advocate general of their service and are a member of another state's bar. This is consistent with how the JAG Corps operates on the federal level. While we typically are able to utilize Minnesota licensed attorneys to provide these services, there are times when we need to go out of state, particularly when senior level members are under investigation for misconduct. This change has been socialized with the Minnesota Office of Lawyer Registration and the Office of Professional Responsibility, and they concur with the change. The second gap this bill fills is the legal authority to receive law enforcement data on National Guard members when they are investigated by local law enforcement. In many cases, when local law enforcement investigates a crime and their prosecutor determines that there is not enough evidence to pursue criminal charges, we still have the ability to pursue administrative action or pursue a court martial. 9 times out of 10, the local jurisdiction provides us the relevant investigation so that we can take action. However, some jurisdictions currently do not, and this simply adds to the time it takes to investigate wrongdoings, since we then must do our own internal investigation, particularly when it comes to sexual assaults. This bill also fills a number of jurisdictional gaps or ambiguities that currently exist on paper. Specifically, it clarifies when members are subject to the Minnesota Code of Military Justice, clarifies which crimes are considered military-specific crimes and therefore give us primary jurisdiction, and clarifies the maximum punishment for the punitive articles of the code. It also specifies that BCA is the investigative arm for the Minnesota National Guard for military-specific crimes. The fourth gap this bill fills is the appellate process for court-martial. Currently, it is unclear how a defendant or the government would appeal a court-martial proceeding. This change clarifies when the appeal period starts to run and clarifies that the appropriate appellate authority is the Minnesota Supreme Court. These changes have also been reviewed and concurred by the Minnesota Attorney General's Appellate Division. And finally, the bill aligns the Minnesota Code with the updates to the federal Uniform Code of Military Justice with respect to newly added punitive articles. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Colonel Blomgren. Next up is Donald J. Kerr, Executive Director, Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. Mr. Kerr, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. I am Don Kerr, the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs, and I know we're pressed for time, so I'm just going to state for the record that this is an agency bill, and I will stand with Lieutenant Colonel Blomgren in case there are any questions from the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr. Any member questions? Seeing none, Representative Zhang will renew his motion that House File 1442 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Yes.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Detmer, aye.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald. Representative McDonald. Representative
McDonald,
Berg.
Aye.
McDonald,
sorry.
Aye. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Poston, aye.
Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Sundin, aye.
Sundin, aye. And there are 13 ayes, 0 nays.
13 ayes and 0 nays. Representative Chair, Vice Chair Zhang, you're on your way to public safety. I will now pass the gavel over to Vice Chair Zhang for the final bill.
All right. Thank you, Chair. Final bill on the agenda is House File 682 from Representative Eklund. Representative Eklund, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, I'll move that House File 682 be referred to the General Register. And I do have an author's amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Eklund moves House File 682 is referred to the General Register. We do have an author's amendment, as Representative Eklund mentioned. Would you like to move the A1 amendment and explain it, or should we adopt it and then you can explain it?
Thank you, Chair Zhang. The A1 amendment just gets the bill in the shape I wanted. It changes a couple of words, and it's pretty self-explanatory.
Okay, all those all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Representative Eklund, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Zhang. The bill provides relief to manufactured home installers, allowing them flexibility to gain their needed continuing education requirements. The law currently sets a standard that simply isn't available for the few number of installers currently in the Minnesota market. Today, I have with me Mr. Mark Bruner to testify. He is the president of the Modular Manufactured Homes Association to answer any questions that members may have.
All right, thank you, Chair. Mr. Mark Brunner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Brunner. I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota, and I would like to also thank Chair Eklund for bringing the bill. What it does is ensure that Minnesota's approximately 70-plus licensed manufactured home installers are able to renew their state licenses and secure the necessary 12 hours of continuing education by offering for the first time an online or an internet-based course option. Under federal and state law, any new or pre-owned manufactured home must be installed on its foundation by a licensed manufactured home installer with a license that renews every 3 years. Dolly does the licensing and CE approvals of manufactured home installers. And over the past several years, Minnesota has witnessed a decline in the number of licensed installers. One reason for surrendering an existing license has been the hurdles in securing the mandated CE courses as compared to surrounding states. And the barrier to the online internet courses from being offered to installers is a provision in statute requiring that internet-based CE courses comply with specific accreditation standards, creating a cost barrier to developing and offering courses for so few license holders. The economies of scale simply aren't there to justify the courses being offered online as compared to courses offered to Minnesota's 20,000 licensed real estate brokers or 15,000 construction trades and contractor licensees. And since 2010, our association has been the only organization in Minnesota to offer in-person courses, and none have taken place due to the pandemic since December of 2019. So what the bill does is provide an exception to the standard so that installers can receive their courses from either an internet or online providers. And since the licensing of installers falls under a federal HUD requirement for approval of all CE courses for all states, so it's a uniform standard nationally, we've identified online installer courses approved directly by HUD and offered by the industry's National Trade Association that are currently used by 35 states and HUD. They're identical to the courses already approved for in-person and classroom learning by Dolly. And considering that manufactured homes are the state's largest source of non-subsidized affordable workforce housing, the bill is greatly appreciated for what it accomplishes in addressing an important impediment to growing the number of installers. Dolly's not opposed to the bill. They retain their authority to approve course curriculum and course sponsors. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
All right, thank you, Mr. Brunner. Member questions or comments for the bill? Seeing none, seeing no further comments. Representative Eklund, any final remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a bill that'll help all our manufactured home installers be able to do their jobs a little easier. I think in this last year, we found out that a lot of us can do things over the internet, even the chairs. So it's It makes things sometimes a little bit easier to get things done and more convenient. So I ask you for your support.
All right. Representative Eklund will renew his motion that House File 682 is referred to the General Register. The committee LA will take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Aye.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Detmer, aye.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, aye.
McDonald, aye. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Poston, aye.
Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. There are 13 ayes, 0 nays.
All right. I'm passing back to Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Vice Chair Zhang. I think we were supposed to say that it's on its way to the General Register, but I guess we know that anyway. So anyway, well, members, we'll have a full day tomorrow. We're getting done here a few minutes early today. I appreciate your time and attention. With that, we're adjourned.